Hello and welcome to episode one of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. Sci-Fi is a weekly philosophy of science podcast, which interviews prominent philosophers of science who engage with scientists in interesting ways. The interviews focus on the origin story of how people found their way into philosophy of science, how they became successful, what current projects they're excited about, and anything else they'd like to discuss. For example, the state of the field, major problems in the sciences and in philosophy, and the future of philosophy of science. Unlike other kinds of podcasts or radio programs that tend to focus on an academic's particular new book or new collection of articles, the focus of this podcast is really on prominent academics as people with thoughts and feelings who at one point or another didn't have it all figured out, and for the most part still don't, but who nevertheless are giving it their all in their fields and working to advance the academic community. So let me tell you a little bit about myself as your host. My name is Nick Zoutra. I'm a doctoral student pursuing a joint PhD in history and philosophy of science and cognitive science at Indiana University Bloomington. I completed my master's in applied ethics in the professions, biomedical and health ethics, and my bachelor's in psychology from Arizona State University. I self-describe as a philosopher of science with broad and interdisciplinary research interests. For example, in addition to general philosophy of science issues, explanation, models, values in science, I have special interests in philosophy of science issues as they arise in psychiatry and the cognitive sciences more generally. I also have research interests in Fourier approaches to cognition, embodied, embedded, and active and extended, empirical approaches to philosophy of mind, computational approaches in the history and philosophy of science, and medical ethics. Now, all the academic spiel aside, generally, I'm just someone who's interested in philosophy and the sciences, and coming to understand how folks from both disciplines, or those who work at the intersection of those disciplines, work together. I think the main motivation for starting a podcast such as this has often come from the repeated attempts to explain to family and friends and other colleagues in academia just what it is philosophers of science actually do. And it turns out that when you ask philosophers of science, they have very different opinions on what it is we tend to do. So I thought, hey, what if I was to get or create some sort of a program or some sort of an avenue that I could discuss and talk with a bunch of philosophers of science, you know, about what it is that they do, what it is they think philosophers of science actually can do, and also the question, what does it mean to do good philosophy of science? So that's the central goal of this particular project. And as I've come to start some of these interviews, what I have found is, again, the human element and that side of understanding how people come to do philosophy of science, I think is very important for trying to understand their own particular approaches. So that has been very fascinating. And I hope you do enjoy these interviews as they come. The plan now is to do about one a week, maybe two, but likely just one for now. Keep listening, and these should be hopefully enjoyable to you. Our first very interview for the very first episode is someone named Massimo Piliucci, professor of philosophy from City University of New York. He's formerly the co-host of the Rationally Speaking podcast and formerly the editor-in-chief from the online magazine Scientia Salon, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He is an outspoken critic of pseudoscience and creationism and an advocate for secularism and science education. Now, he is particularly special, but he has not one, not two, but three PhDs. He has a PhD in, he's a doctorate in genetics from the University of Ferrara in Italy. He's a PhD in botany from the University of Connecticut. And most recently, a PhD in philosophy of science from the University of Tennessee. He's a very fascinating individual. He's a pleasure to chat with, and I hope you enjoy listening to him. So without further ado, let's go and talk to Massimo. Do you have any fun teaching duties this term?
Yeah, this semester I'm teaching an experimental course in applied stoicism, which is something completely new for me. Because it's got nothing to do with philosophy of science, which is my actual field of research. But since I got interested in Stoicism, you know, the ancient Greek-Roman philosophy a couple of years ago, And then I sort of started practicing because there's actually people, believe it or not, in sort of modern times that have taken up Stoicism as a sort of a type of mindful practice and sort of general philosophy of life. It's kind of analogous to Buddhism, sort of the equivalent, the Western equivalent of Buddhism.
Yeah.
Not as popular, of course.
Sure. Now, I've heard of this in certain practices. So what is an example of applied Stoicism? Is it something where you're, this is a very just general understanding of attempting to not attach oneself to any particular emotion, or would that be an example, or maybe you could fill us in?
That's actually something that is a common misconception about Stoicism that it.
Oh, perfect.
About.
Okay. Great. Glad I could lead that in perfectly.
Yeah. That it is about sort of suppressing emotions. What in terms of emotions, the Stoics actually try to control the negative ones, such as fear or anger. And develop the positive ones, such as sort of love or a sense of justice or things like that. But yeah, basically, you know, without getting into much details, because this is about philosophy of science.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I just, yeah.
But so just to give you an idea, what it is there's two components to it. There's a theory. You know, this is a philosophy. It's not just a practice or a kind of a cognitive therapy, although actually...
Like meditation, mindfulness or something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, actually, it turns out that modern cognitive behavioral therapy has taken a lot, it's borrowed a lot from Stoic techniques. But modern Stoicism is basically a combination of the philosophy, so it gives you a general view of life, you know, what is important in life and what is not important. So for a Stoic, what is of paramount importance in life is... the practice of the fundamental virtues of practical wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice, and on the one hand, so mm-hmm. there's the theory there,
uh-huh.
and so that basically changes the entire way in which you think about stuff, because then your priorities are completely different from what they would be otherwise.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then there is a set of techniques of actual, you know, mindfulness techniques and ways to deal with stress and, you know, everyday problems. So these range from doing a sort of a morning meditation to try to visualize things that could possibly go wrong during the day and sort of mentally prepare to sort of realize, you know, to react properly or in the best way possible. To something like an evening sort of philosophical diary where you go over the major things that have happened during the day and you ask yourself, well, what did I do wrong and what did I do right and mm-hmm. what could I do better next time? You know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, perhaps we can pick this up later on in the conversation. I'd be interested to hear, yeah, how does this particular practice, this theory and the practice differ from those other things, such other kinds of similarly related topics such as mindfulness or
yeah.
you know just and journaling in general, just being mindful
right.
about your day, how, thinking about. Well, great! Right. It sounds like sounds like a wonderful course. I'm hoping it goes well this term.
Yeah. These students are really getting into it. I mean, most of them were sort of actually somewhat familiar with some of the techniques because they picked them up from other things like in psychology
sure.
Courses. But they were completely unaware that, you know, there were people 2,000 years ago or so writing about this stuff, and so it's just mind blowing for them, which is good. That's what you want to do with students, you know, open up new vistas and think about things that they had not considered before.
Yeah, it's certainly pictured as a historically new idea, but in reality, you see, yeah, that's really great. That's great. They're having
right.
those kind of reactions. So let's start at the beginning. So where are you from, Massimo?
So I grew up in Italy, in Rome, but I actually was born in Liberia, which is on the western side of Africa. The reason for that is because my father was working for a British company overseeing road constructions all over Africa, really. And when he met my mother in Rome, he was at the time working in Liberia, so they went down together and I was born there. But I only stayed a few months. Apparently, my family decided that Rome was a better place to raise a kid than Liberia.
Yeah, yeah. What was like? What was the climate like in Liberia at the time?
Well, I think this at the time was going through one of a number of dictatorships, and so it was a little difficult in terms of sort of both culturally, of course, it was very different for a European, but also it was as it turns out later on. In fact, they've gone through a couple of revolutions and fairly large amount of turmoil. And only recently, only in the last few years, actually, Liberia has gotten back to a somewhat calm situation. So my parents probably made the right decision. So I grew up in Rome.
Sure.
And, you know, that's when I was a kid, I was interested in science.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my family lore has it, I don't remember it, but family lore has it that I announced that I was going to become a scientist at age five.
You know? At age five?
Yeah, yeah. And initially, I wanted to be an astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, between junior high school and early high school, middle school and junior high school, I kind of changed my mind and moved to biology. And sure enough, I went on to college studying biology, and I became an evolutionary professional evolutionary biologist. That was the first part of my career.
Yeah, but so really quickly, so what was the shift like? Like how did that come about from going from generally interested in astronomy into biology as the focus?
Part of it was the result of sort of serendipity, and part of it was sort of thought out. The serendipitous part was simply that the University of Rome did not offer a degree in astronomy.
Sure.
It offered a degree in physics with a specialization in astronomy, but that's not what I wanted to do. And so I would have had to move to Bologna, which is in northern Italy, and I didn't want to do that. So that was the serendipitous part. The more sort of thoughtful part was that, you know, I kept studying in high school. I went to something called the Scientific Lyceum in high school, and that's basically preparatory for people who want to go to college in the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what you do is you get a good exposure of, you know, several years of physics, several years of biology, and then you study earth sciences and chemistry and so on and so forth. And the more I studied the two, the more I said, oh, well, I like the physics and the astronomy, but not as much actually as it turns out as the biology. So I switched.
That's perfect. Do you recall any questions that you were curious about growing up? Anything, you know, during that time that was particularly compelling to you?
Let's see. When I was interested in astronomy, my particular interest was in what is called planetology, so comparative study of planets, atmospheres, and geology. There was at the time, this was the time, imagine, of the Viking landing on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a kid in junior high school when that happened, and
it was
so exciting. I mean, it was in sort of live TV, and it was happening while I was there, and I was watching it, and I was listening to scientists making, you know, comments on it. And so that was one of the things that really influenced my interest at that time. Later on, when I started studying biology more seriously, pretty quickly I went from an interest in ecology and behavior to an interest in genetics. As soon as I picked up a book in genetics, I was just hooked.
How did you get hooked in genetics? I mean, not everyone is a geneticist.
Genetics offered an interesting combination, I think, in biology, because eventually then I became what is called an evolutionary geneticist. So somebody who applies genetics to evolutionary questions. And to me, that was the best of both worlds, where the two worlds are genetics is about it's pretty hard science. It's experimentally based. It's, you know, strong on experimental side, while evolutionary biology is a historical science. I mean, you always have to take into account the past evolutionary history of organisms that you're working with, because different organisms will give you different results because they have experienced different evolutionary pathways. So this idea of combining a hard science with historical science really appealed to me, and therefore genetics, in particular evolutionary genetics, sort of became the obvious choice.
So you studied in Rome, and you said your first career was really evolutionary biologist, or more specifically defined, an evolutionary geneticist.
Right. Yeah. So I got a degree in Rome, undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's the Italian laurea is really equivalent to a combination of undergraduate degree and master's.
Yeah, I was curious. Yeah. So is it a 4 or 5 year term of study, or is it like?
Right. It's a 4 year term of study, but it includes a fairly sizable component of laboratory work and a thesis that you have to write.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so Then after that, I did actually a doctoral degree, so the European equivalent of a PhD in genetics, in population genetics.
And this is right after school, correct? Right after your...
That's right. That was after... So I I graduated from the University of Rome, and then I moved to do my doctorate in at the University of Ferrara, which is in northern Italy near Venice. At that point, I finished that lasts about 3 years. I finished that, defending my thesis. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I was publishing, of course. And I landed basically what it's the equivalent of a postdoc position at the National Research Council, which is a national organization in Italy that has a number of laboratories throughout the territory that do different things. And the one that I landed into was specializing in applied genetics. We were working on things like chestnut, for instance, so plants that are of agricultural interest. And then I stayed there for a couple of years, a little less than 2 years, and then I decided that it was pretty clear that if I wanted to really become an evolutionary biologist, I had to move out of Italy and at least spend some time in the United States. So that's what I did.
Was it just the state, like the where the research was happening, happened to be more U.S. centric, or how did you make that decision?
Well, there were more opportunities in terms of jobs for one thing, but also yes, the kind of work that I wanted to do, which was to study gene environment interactions, or basically nature nurture kind of questions. The best people that were doing that at the time were definitely in the United States, in particular. This guy named Carl Schlichting, who was at the University of Connecticut. And so here a funny thing happened, however. So I write to Carl, and I got in touch with him, and then we met at a couple of different meetings, professional meetings. And so we developed a good relationship, and I say, I'd like to come and do a postdoc with you. And his answer was, well, I'm a freshly appointed assistant professor. I don't have money for a postdoc. but I can offer you a position as a graduate student at the university. I said, would I want to be a graduate student?
Like, why would I want to go? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I got my doctorate, and I've actually already done a postdoc, so why would I want to go back? And he said, he made a very persuasive case.
Sure.
He said, well, look, if you're interested in pursuing a career in the United States, probably an American degree will be significantly helpful. We can give you a special deal. You'll teach less, do more research, and we'll pay you a little bit more. And basically, you come in and do whatever you want. So I thought about it.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, it sounds like a good deal. And so I accepted. And I moved to Connecticut. And it was one of the best decisions in my life, because to make a very long story short, by the time Carl and I exhausted our collaboration, which was several years after I finished my PhD with him, basically we published all the papers that came out of our collaboration. Mm-hmm. We counted 17 papers and one book. And that's a hell of a lot more than you normally get out of a PhD.
Yeah, I think that's about three or four times as much as counting correctly. Yeah, and that's even with a good student. So yeah.
And that was because of a combination of things, right? On the one hand, I wasn't your typical graduate student. I already had a degree, so I already knew what I wanted to do. I knew how to...
You essentially acted as a postdoc, that's great.
So that was a great decision. Then finally, after that, I did my actual postdoc in the United States at Brown University.
Okay.
For 1 year, doing evolutionary genetics. And then I landed my first job at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville as an assistant professor.
Great. As in the biology department, I could imagine.
In a combination of botany. At the time, there was a botany department and an ecology and evolutionary biology department. So,
Okay. Oh, great.
I had a split appointment in those. And there I did my whole career basically as a biologist. Oh, sorry. I shouldn't say that. But I went through all the ranks, meaning I started out as assistant professor.
Assistant to... Yeah, how far along in the track, did you go through?
I went all the way to, I got tenure, so then I became associate professor, and then I became a full professor at the University of Tennessee.
Wow.
At that point, something else funny happened. I basically went through an early midlife crisis. I was in my, late 30s, early 40s.
Sure.
And I said, okay, I need to do something different. because I figured, oh, I've been doing this now for, you know, almost 20 years.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's what's going well, but I could keep going this for the rest of my career, but that's, you know, that beginning is, it's beginning to sound like coasting, you know, feel like coasting. So let's do something different. Now, typically when people have a midlife crisis, you know, what they do, at least in Italy, I don't know about here.
What do they do in Italy? I don't
know. they get themselves a Ferrari and a younger, you know, partner. I get money for a Ferrari.
Sure.
Yeah. So instead of doing that, and besides, I was married at the time. So instead of doing that, then I said, aha. Let me shop around for something different to do. And at that point, again, this combination of sort of deliberate thinking and serendipity, which is probably how many decisions in life are made, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the deliberate part, was this, like, okay, I need to look for something else, and I have some interest in this or that. You know, let's see what I can do. Mm-hmm. The serendipitous part is that while I was thinking about this, the University of Tennessee philosophy department hired a young assistant professor named Jonathan Kaplan. Mm-hmm. Jonathan had just finished his thesis with John Dupre at Stanford on, guess what, nature-nurture questions, right? And so, in fact, he had cited a number of my papers in his thesis and one of my books. And so he came on campus. He knew I was there. So he looked me up, and we met, and we became immediately friends. We just hit it off very well.
Yeah, so did you guys end up co-writing a book together? Is that true?
We ended up co-writing a number of papers first. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, I still remember it very clearly. We were having lunch, and I said, Jonathan, as you know, I've been thinking about sort of shifting my career in different directions. I've always had an interest in philosophy since high school, because in high school, I took 3 years of philosophy courses. And I said, okay, how about I enroll into the PhD program at the University of Tennessee in philosophy, and you be my mentor. Hmm. And Jonathan looked at me and said, how many glasses of wine did you have today? And I said, none. You know that I don't drink at lunch. So, you know, after the initial shock, kind of, you know, he agreed, and we went to the dean to ask for permission to do this thing. And basically what happened, which was a little, you know, strange, because here was a full professor who was going back to school,
yeah.
You know, back to school, basically, and being mentored by an assistant professor without tenure, right? So the situation was a little delicate. But the dean agreed to oversee this and to allow this. So for 3 years, I kept running the lab during the day. Fortunately, I had just gotten a large NSF grant, and I had...
So that probably barred... You didn't have to teach, I imagine, once you got that grant.
Right. I had a reduced teaching.
Oh, okay. Okay, sure.
And also, I had two postdocs and three very, very good graduate students who basically ran the lab on their own. So, but I was there during the day, and then in the evening, I would walk across campus and take courses in the philosophy department. And my first one was Plato, on Plato.
Okay, so you went to a philosophy night school, apparently.
Yes, right.
Great.
Yes. Then 3 years later, I defended my thesis, and that's the book that you're talking about. It's Making Sense of Evolution, which I published for Chicago Press with Jonathan. That was my dissertation in philosophy.
Wow, yeah.
So at that point, I was in a little bit of a weird situation, because my publication output at that point was on average 2/3 biology papers, you know, typically empirically, you know, experimental papers, and 1/3 philosophy papers. And at that point, I was hired away from Tennessee by Stony Brook University, by the Ecology and Evolution Department there. The Ecology and Evolution Department at Stony Brook is one of the best in the country. It's got a long, long history of just to give you an example, you know, the first day that I was there in the life sciences building, I, you know, kept going around and looking at doors and names on the doors. And, you know, a full quarter, maybe even more, of the faculty there were people on whose textbooks I had studied when I was in graduate school. So that was a great thing. So they hired me as a biologist. I moved my lab to Long Island. And I was there for 5 years as a full-time faculty, as a full professor. Mm-hmm. And at which point, and we're getting close to the end of this long story.
No, no, this is great. This is great. Yeah. So you went to philosophy, but then now you're still, you know, given your track record as more, I suppose, hireable in terms of as a biologist, you get Stony Brook, which again is this, you know, it could be seen as a move up in the career.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Definitely was a move up. And then finally, what happened was that I was living on Long Island, and I was only 40 miles or so from New York City. And having grown up in Rome, I said, you know, what the hell are you doing on Long Island? Just move to New York. You know, you like large cities. You like the hustle and bustle, and you know, the theaters and the music and all that. So it's like, just move. So I did. I moved to New York. And I kept working at Stony Brook, however, for a while. Which
how far is the how's the commute? Would you say
it's 2 hours one way by train?
Okay, that's doable.
It's doable, but it was a little, you know, it was getting hard.
Sure. Yeah, it's not easy. I can imagine. Yeah,
right. So I finally said, okay, why don't we look for a job in the city? Now the problem is, of course, everybody wants to work in the city.
Yeah,
it's a very competitive environment. So I said, all right. How about by that time I had, of course, kept publishing in biology, but also I had a significant number of publications in philosophy. And so I said, why don't we apply to whatever jobs come out, either in biology or in philosophy or both? The first one that came out was a CUNY and was in philosophy.
Hmm.
And I applied and they hired me. And that's how I switched full time to philosophy.
Wow. How did you feel after finally getting this, finding your place in philosophy?
It was very weird.
Sure, sure.
Because it was a completely different way of doing things, you know, completely different type of, you know, colleagues and topics. But it was also very exciting. I said, wow. So I started this shift, you know, several years ago. And then now it finally culminates with a position.
That's great. So how does it go? How does it feel to go from
New York, and I'm living exactly in the place where I want to live?
Yeah. So now I was curious. So I myself come from the sciences. I've come in from psychology and neuroscience and made the shift into a philosophy of science. How does it feel to go, you know, from a laboratory collaborative setting in that way to doing philosophy full time?
Well, I'll tell you, two things have been very clear in my mind after the switch. One is that actually, I've gotten probably to a point, you know, we're different people at different stages of our life. And I've actually gotten significantly more, I guess one way to put it would be misanthropic. But sort of, I feel much more comfortable being on my own for a long times during the week. And so now actually being in my office most of the day, writing or reading on my own with very little contact with other people actually feels great.
Sure.
But when I was younger, being in the lab and also in the field with graduate students also felt great. So it was like, it's a question of, you know, different temperaments.
Certain contexts, yeah.
But that's one thing. The other thing that it's weird is that I naively, as it turns out, when I made the switch, I thought that, okay, well, I'm going to be in an interesting situation here because I'm going to be, from the point of view of the philosophers, I'm going to be a scientist who actually has decided to take philosophy seriously enough to go back to graduate school and, you know, go through the ropes, basically. So I'm not a scientist who plays at being a philosopher.
Sure. You've gone, right? Yeah.
But at the same time, I figured, you know, for my science colleagues, I'm one of them, you know, they know me, and so that they there's a sort of reputation that I built over the years. So I figured, mistakenly, as it turns out, you know, that this would be one way to bring together the two sides of what C.P. Snow famously referred to as the, you know, the two cultures.
Sure.
And exactly the opposite happened. Of my philosophy colleagues, I'm still too much of a scientist because I keep asking questions about, oh, but wait a minute, what's the empirical evidence for that? and for my science colleagues, I'm way too much of a philosopher because I keep asking them questions like, well, but wait a minute, what do you mean by that? And what is the import of that? And, you know, what can we dissect that concept? And so it's like, it's...
You're caught in the middle.
It's an interesting situation. Yeah. I got caught in the middle. But it's actually a position that I feel comfortable with. I'm perfectly okay. It's an unusual situation because I really am you know, when I write about philosophy of science, I really know the science when I write about biology, because I was a biologist. I am a biologist still. And so it's like, it puts me in a very unusual situation. And, you know, if that makes me a little bit of an outsider in both fields, you know, so be it. It's not a big deal.
Sure, sure. So have you been in the philosophy of science for a little while. Have you seen the two cultures coming together a little bit more, or at least in certain disciplines like biology or let's say psychology and philosophy? Have you seen that at all, or how would you say the state of the field is right now?
Yes and no. So I've seen a lot of coming together. Well, I shouldn't say a lot, but a significant amount of coming together, both in biology and, probably you're right, in sort of psychology and cognitive science, although that's a little farther away from what I do, so I'm less confident. But in biology, certainly. I mean, I've seen a number of colleagues in the sciences going to meetings at the Philosophy of Science Association, and I know a number of scientists who co-write papers with philosophers. And more importantly, I guess, I know a number of scientists, biologists, who do take seriously, the philosophy. They don't necessarily know it or even read it, but when they talk to a philosopher, they don't just, you know, dismiss it. So in that sense, there's been arguably progress, and that's a good thing. What I've seen, a more complicated situation, is in physics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm not a philosopher of physics, obviously. But strangely enough, I've been invited to a number of meetings and conversations with physicists, because fundamental physics, as you probably know, it's going through a little bit of a rough time with internal strife, you know, very public internal strife.
So what are some of the bigger, more contested issues going through it right now?
Well, so there's this big issue of where the next big theory is coming from. And, you know, string theory has been around for a long time. The notions like the multiverse have been around for a long time. But they keep eluding any novel, any way to produce novel empirical predictions. There's no empirical testing of these things. So inside within the physics community, people have started getting a little restless. To the point that, last year there was this, you know, big brouhaha about a couple of physicists publishing a op-ed in Nature magazine, basically asking their colleagues to just take back their field because physics is going in the wrong direction. It's going to, you know, basically metaphysical speculation that is completely disconnected from empirical evidence.
And was this directed toward theoretical physicists or?
Right. That was written by some theoretical physicists, directed at their colleagues, and basically say, you know, forget about multiverse and string theory. That's basically metaphysics. Move back to the lab and let's do something that we can actually, you know, sink our teeth in.
Sure.
And then the response on the other side has been actually to articulate even notions that sometimes are referred to as sort of post-empirical science. You know, it's like, okay, well, let's bite the bullet. Yes, we cannot do an experiment to test string theory, so we're going to validate the theory in other ways in terms of sort of consistency and, you know, elegance and things like that. So as you can imagine, that's a big discussion. And it was interesting, it was amusing to being called. There was a meeting about this, where a number of physicists, theoretical physicists, were present, including one or two Nobel Prizes. And this was in Munich, in Germany, last year. And I was invited by the organizers, and I said, why are you inviting me? I'm not a physicist or a philosopher of physics. And they said, well, yes, but that's true, but one of your interests in philosophy of science is the demarcation problem.
In your book, Philosophy of Pseudoscience.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So I said, okay, fine. So I said, but what has that to do with it? I mean, nobody seriously will argue that string theory is science, pseudoscience. You know, they may argue that it's none, sort of, that it is metaphysical speculation, but it's certainly nobody's going to be accusing people of, you know, string theory stuff doing pseudoscience. But it turns out that the accusations that were thrown so one way or the other actually focused on one very, very crucial figure in philosophy of science called Popper.
Hmm.
So Popper is the guy that actually came up with the demarcation problem originally, right? So in the, at the beginning of the 20th century, Popper was in fact bothered by a number of things, including the Hume's problem of induction, and also, which he saw connected to the problem of induction, the separation, the distinction between science and non-science, and particularly science and pseudoscience. So he proposed his famous criterion of falsifiability as a way to separate science from non-science, right? He said, if a notion, a theory, a hypothesis is at least potentially empirically falsifiable, meaning that it can be shown to be false if it is false, then that's science. If it cannot be falsified, then it's not science. Now, things are a lot more complicated than that because, for instance, as Popper himself realized, notions like astrology, which are clearly pseudoscientific, I hope I'm not offending any of your listeners, but, you know, it is.
So I don't think you'll be offending too many people.
Yeah. Astrology, however, is in fact falsifiable. I mean, and in fact, it has been falsified. You know, people have done experiments, you know, giving, you know, sort of profiles of, you know, psychological profiles of people with different astrological signs to astrologers and asking them to, you know, identify to what sign they belong. And, you know, the astrologers have, you know, failed abysmally at doing that sort of stuff. So Popper did know this, and he said, well, yes, what happened there is that astrology has become a pseudoscience because once falsified, instead of admitting the falsification and moving on to something else, astrologers basically dug their heels in, and they said, no, there's something wrong with the methods, there's something wrong with, you know, the scientific worldview sort of stuff. Okay, fine. So that's Popper. Now, what the hell has that to do with string theory? Turns out that both pro and anti-string theory people have thrown Popper at each other, basically. So the anti-string theory people have made the argument, I think reasonably enough, that, look, string theory fails Popper's criterion of falsifiability. It's just like it's not falsifiable, so it's not science. It may not be pseudoscience, but it's not science. On the other side, pro-string theory people or pro-multiverse people like the cosmologist Sean Carroll, for instance, said, oh, you guys are paparazzi. That you're using a criterion
that's new. I hadn't heard that one. Yeah.
I know, right? you just thrown these things out and this is a criterion that really shouldn't be part of science. It shouldn't be used because it's just too strict. You cannot demand ahead of time what scientific theories, what counts as a scientific theory or not. So basically, the organizers of the Munich workshop said, okay, why don't you come in and explain to the physicists here on both sides of the debate what exactly Popper said, because most of these people have actually not read Popper, they've read the Wikipedia version of Popper.
Well, Popper is very popular in the sciences. Amongst the scientists, you take courses with the scientists, and if you mention yourself as a philosopher of science, they'll be like, oh, Popper. Yeah, of course.
Right. But most of the times they haven't read it.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Why would they? It's not part of what they do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So basically I was asked to provide sort of a Popper 101, basically, thing. Mm-hmm. And also what I did, I said, look, Popper is certainly an important figure in the philosophy of science. He was highly influential, and one shouldn't discard, you know, just throw away the idea of falsifiability, you know, just casually. But at the same time, you know, Popper was active between the 1930s and the 1960s mostly. You know, we're in 2016, 15 when I gave that talk. I said, look, a lot has happened in philosophy of science in the meantime. And if you really want to use philosophy of science, which I think you should, as at least a conversation partner to figure out what is the status of your own theories and your own field at this point, you should definitely, by all means, invite philosophers of science, mostly philosophers of physics, really, to the conversation table. But you should also catch up a little bit on things, you know, not being 50 years behind curve. And so I gave him sort of basically a little overview of
a little workshop of this is what philosophers of science have been doing for the past 60 years.
Yeah. So it would be weird, let's say, if I were a philosopher of physics and for me, physics stopped in the 1950s. or 60s. It's like that would be weird. Right? It's just like, wait a minute, what did you been? What about the rest?
Yeah, that's a good that's a good comparison. I think that would be Well, great, and that I imagine So that went over well. You've been doing a lot of other interviews recently. Is any particular other interviews have been that you've really liked so far?
You know, the interviews that I do tend to be on three topics, basically, these days. One is the stoicism that we talked about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. One is this demarcation problem usually about actual pseudoscience, but often enough, as I said, about also physics and things. And then there is this other thing about artificial intelligence that somehow keeps popping up.
Hmm.
And which is, again, weird because I'm not a philosopher of mind, right? But I am a biologist. And,
sure.
You know, and there is, and of course, the brain is, in fact, a biological organ. And so there is actually something to be said there. And I guess I built a reputation for adopting a position that is a minority position within philosophy of mind, which is I'm not a computationalist. I think that there is something fairly incomplete about computationalist theories of mind.
Sure.
Meaning that, you know, I do think that certainly the brain has computational aspects. And it's also true that if you define computation broadly enough, then sure, everything the brain does, it becomes a computation. Although when you expand the definition of computation that much, it turns out that even rocks that change position on the ground are doing computations, which I find completely unhelpful.
You would get along with a lot of people at Indiana, I got to say.
Is that right?
This is a hub of West Coast philosophy of mind. Just, you know, dynamical systems views all varieties are very welcome in Indiana, distinct from the East Coast philosophy, as we've learned in our introductory courses. Certainly, I like how you make that caveat. Certainly not everything is not completely non-computational, but...
Right.
Sure.
Also, as a biologist, I take a position that actually substrate does matter. So for me, consciousness and you know, sort of higher level mental functioning are evolved biological phenomena. We have no reason to believe, despite what you might have heard recently, that, you know, plants are conscious. Or even worse, I just wrote a blog post this week on panpsychism, which is the latest fashion in philosophy of mind.
It's the latest fashion? Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I remember going to some consciousness conferences, and of course, it's always there. I didn't really know it was in fashion, though. That's fascinating.
Yeah, David Chalmers is here at NYU, and he's, you know, he's a big pusher of this kind of thing. And I just don't buy it. I just say, you know, that makes no sense to me. From first of all, it's not helpful because panpsychism actually doesn't explain anything. It's just a fancy label to say we have no idea what the hell is going on. So let's call it panpsychism. But more importantly, you know, I do take seriously the biology. I think that the only evidence that we have at this point is that consciousness evolved in certain kinds of primates. It may be present in other primates, not just humans. I'm not, you know, we're not sure about this. It's hard to tell. It may actually have evolved in other animals. I mean, there, you know, some marine mammals are possible candidates. Maybe octopi are candidates. But what we do know is that it requires a certain, you know, a fairly sophisticated neural machinery to do that, to achieve that sort of higher level mental functioning. And it seems pretty clear that it is a physical system whose operations depend on the physicality of that system. So that I don't believe for a second that if you substitute, you know, let's say every single neuron in the brain with something made of cardboard, but it has the exact same structure, you will get consciousness. The hell you would. You will get nothing. And, you know, I'm often accused, when I say that, I'm accused of some kind of vitalism or some kind of, like, but I say...
Some sort of essentialism.
It's essentialism. It's like, but no, wait a minute. I'm simply making a point that every biologist will readily agree with. It's like, yeah, stuff matter. You know, what you're made of matters. It's not because there's nothing magical about it. It's just that... However, you have to have certain physical chemical properties, not just informational properties.
Okay.
Right? The big deal about the information approach is that you can completely abstract from the specifics of the physical system and still retain essentially, you know, I would call that an essence, actually, of the thing. But that to me sounds weird. It seems, first of all, it seems dualistic to begin with. I mean, people are, you know, some of these hard computationists are basically making a huge, a sharp distinction between hardware and software. And to me, that smells a little too uncomfortably of dualism. Of course, not Cartesian dualism, but nonetheless.
Sure. A different kind of dual. Yeah.
And in fact, Chalmers admits to it. I mean, he says, I'm a dualist. I'm a process dualist and not a substance dualist.
Okay? He was the one that sort of advocated for dualism, but kind of wrote quite a bit.
He definitely advocates for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Okay. So that's one of the things that it's going on, and it's that's sort of, since you asked, I'm going to finish quickly. So that has led also to my appearance on the Colbert Report.
Really?
So this is weird.
I can't believe I'm embarrassed at it. When did this happen?
This happened just shortly before the Colbert Report went off the air.
Oh, gosh. So okay. I have to watch the episode. That's phenomenal. Yeah. So how was going being on the Colbert Report?
It was a lot of fun.
I bet. That's unreal.
Yeah. It took a whole afternoon to take those, you know, what eventually became like 2 minutes thing. But it was a lot of fun. It was definitely a lot of fun. But what happened was this, that so once you start being sort of critical of strong computationalism in philosophy of mind, then you immediately run up against the mind uploading crowd.
Oh, sure.
The singularity crowd and all that, of which, by the way, Chalmers is an exponent. He's one of them. But I published a technical paper in a chapter in a book answering Chalmers' writings about the singularity. The idea of a singularity, which is this idea, you know, for your listeners,
sure.
This idea that computers are improving so fast that at some point very soon we will reach a point where it'll be smarter than we are. That point is the singularity. After that, computers will basically take off on their own and either kill the rest of kill humanity or do something weird. I don't believe for a second that that's going to happen. Certainly not within the lifetime of the people that keep telling us that, it's only 20 years down the road.
Yeah, sure.
And that 20 years window, by the way, keeps moving for some reason. But anyway, so I don't believe that for a second for similar reasons. So since I don't accept a fully computational theory of mind, then I don't accept that computers can turn into us just by increasing computational speed or memory or whatever it is. I'm not saying that one could not produce artificial consciousness. That's perfectly possible. I'm just saying that the iPad that I'm talking through in order to communicate with you is not one of those things. Mm-hmm. And a very, very complicated iPad is just not going to do it. It's still going to be an iPad. So that runs against, you know, the singularity people. It runs against the mind uploading, because one of the people, the major exponents of these singularity I was about to use the word cult, and then probably, but anyway,
you can hear for it.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil is a very smart guy. He's currently working for Google. You know, he has a lot of patents and inventions, and he's definitely not a stupid individual. But he does subscribe to these sort of weird notions, and so the Colbert people at discovered that up in I think it's Vermont or New Hampshire, one of those northern New England states, there was this woman who has built a artificial, you know, basically a head that talks to her and that she thinks is going to eventually be basically a way to upload minds and you know, this computer is going to become a person and all that. Now, if you look at the video, it's really weird and it's really creepy, because they actually went there and interviewed this woman and her computer.
So who's behind the – is this – but there's no one – I mean, is this just an AI computer or is this –
AI.
Okay, that you're communicating with, sure.
Right. And so it's really weird. It's really creepy.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah. So they brought me into the show as the skeptic, essentially, right? So,
perfect.
So they you can see that they cut between the interview with the woman and the weird head, talking head, AI talking head. And then they have comments from me to the effect that, that's not going to happen.
Like, oh, that's ridiculous. Like, yeah, sure. Oh, that's great. That it must have been something to, that is really, I'll have to go watch that video now of the weird lady and the talking head and follow up with your interview.
Sure.
Well, so great. So we're coming to the end. It's, this has been great. So what are you working on now?
Well, a couple of things. There's, I just finished actually writing a book on Stoicism for a broader audience. For the general public, it's coming out by Basic Books next year in April, hopefully. It's called How to Be a Stoic.
Oh, great.
And so that should be fun when it comes out. I also am putting the finishing touches on a co-edited book for Chicago Press. This one is a technical one with my longtime collaborator, Martin Baudry, who is at the University of Ghent in Belgium. And this book is sort of, we think of it as sort of the mirror image of the one that we did on the philosophy of pseudoscience, which you mentioned earlier. So we're looking at a different demarcation problem. The new book is going to be about scientism. So this idea that some people say that science is being pushed as the only way of knowing things and the ultimate arbiter about everything in human life, right? So that position is referred to as scientism. So we asked a bunch of people what they thought about this, and when we collected a number of really interesting chapters from people that range from very critical of scientism or scientistic positions to actually a number of people who completely endorse it and say, oh, this is the great thing, the greatest thing since sliced bread.
So there's some folks, so would popular celebrity scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye and those people, would they fall into the scientism camp?
Yes, they would definitely fall into that camp. However, we did not ask them because they're popularizers, as you just said.
You're looking at more academics, researchers that are, or philosophers who are generally interested in this question. Maybe sociologists or communications experts, etc.
Exactly. And so the philosophers that are definitely on the scientific side of things by their own light are James Lediman, for instance, who is a philosopher of physics, and Alex Rosenberg.
Yeah.
So, you know, those people. And on the other side, there is also a number of people, including myself, actually, that are actually more critical of scientism. But even the criticism of scientism has different versions of it. You know, there's a more extreme version where it's like, no, science is just another epistemic activity in justice as valid as any other. Two positions that are a little bit kind of in between, like my own. I do think that science, you know, I'm a scientist, so I do think that science is by far the best way that we've come up in order to investigate natural phenomena. But I do think also that it has comparatively little to say about a number of important issues, such as, let's say, ethics, just to pick on the obvious one, or even aesthetics, actually. And, I think that there is quite a bit of space there for philosophical reflection, for other kinds of approaches to understanding certain issues, which is not to say that science cannot provide input into, let's say, ethical discussions. I think it can and it does.
Well, sure. There's a lot of big moral psychology work now that people were doing. But then you'll be quick to note those who do, let's say, those who are working on philosophical reflection on, I don't know, resentment or, some kind of like, concept, philosophical concept, as opposed to then doing empirical work. Well,
those are the two major projects that are about to come out next year. And we'll see after that.
Well, great. Well, so for the listeners who are generally interested in philosophy of science or philosophers of science themselves, do you have any recommendations? You know, what would you encourage those of us who are, aspiring philosophers of science to go out and do?
Well, read a lot. talk a lot to other people. I would also encourage to, if one is inclined, to do what I've been doing now for a number of years, which is write a blog.
Oh, yeah.
you know, there are some good blogs about philosophy out there, and I think we need more because it's an important way to do outreach to a broader audience, including an audience of scientists, frankly. So, you know, my own blog, it's not specifically about philosophy or science, it's sort of general philosophy, but
sure.
As it turns out, a lot of what I publish there is, in fact, philosophy of science, because that's my main interest.
Yeah.
So that one is platofootnote.org.
Okay, great.
But there are a number of other good blogs, and I would say that it's important that the new generations, especially from the get-go, start publishing, you know, start talking to a broader public, not afraid of giving public talks or doing podcasts like you're doing, or, you know, blogs and things like that, because the academy is changing, and, you know, the old generation is kind of wary and even skeptical or even contemptuous, actually, of these new technologies and new outreach. But, you know, the good things about the old generation is that they're all going through, they're going to retire. So
there will be room or new kinds of things going on. No, I've heard things like, you know, doing a video blog of your papers or something like that. And that like doing like a video, you know, sort of like creating new ways with which to share your papers, your work, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Exactly.
Well, that's great. Well, Maso, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. You're quite articulate. You're quite intelligent. You're a pleasure to have on the show, and I really appreciate you coming and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I hope I'm really excited to hear about how the course in Stoicism goes, applied Stoicism at CUNY, and we'll be very looking forward to check out those two new books that will be coming out very soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good rest of the day. We'll talk to you soon.
Sure.